And now we'd like to...
Mr. Freeberg?
Yes, who are you?
I'm Mary Ann Feemster. I'm 10 years old. I've been sitting in the audience.
Yes.
I've been thinking over what you said about how you're doing this because there aren't any more radio programs.
Yes.
Mr. Freeberg, what's a radio program?
Well, when you listen to the radio in the morning, what do you hear?
Disc jockeys and news, or sometimes news and disc jockeys. Is it possible to hear something else?
It was back in the 1940s, yes.
Back in the olden days?
Yes. There were what we call radio programs, like what we're doing here with actors and live musicians and sound effects men and guest stars.
Oh, you mean like a television program when the picture tube blows out.
In the 1950s, when Stan Freberg produced his now classic defense of radio, television was rapidly overshadowing the audio medium. 50 years later, when the competition for the public ear and eye is more diverse than ever, what does radio have to offer? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Ear.
As far back as the late 1940s, radio entertainers were making jokes about TV taking over the airwaves and bringing the demise of long-running radio shows. Today, whether it's entertainment or news, iPods, and for that matter, cell phones can spread it around faster than broadcasting can. How does radio fit into the future of communication? Again, this week, our guest is Michelle Hilmes, professor of media and cultural studies and director of the Wisconsin Center for Film and Theater Research at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you. Delightful to be here again.
Well, let's start with those olden days that they were just referring to, the 1940s. Take us back to the time when TV and radio were really starting to compete.
Well, it's a fascinating thing in this country particularly that the two media diverged as much as they did. If you went to England, for instance, you would see that there was more of a continuity of radio programs. But here, what with television, the new medium, and all the advertisers and the stars and the programs jumping over to TV, it really was a time when people were saying, you know, radio, it's going to be dead. You know, there's nothing more for it. And I think it's remarkable that what the little girl was posing as, you know, what radio just is by that time was a new invention of the 1940s. Radio reinvented itself. It went back to being a kind of local medium the way it had been back in the 1920s and 30s, but had ceased to be by the 40s. Local DJs playing records for the local audience, new audiences like African Americans who really had never been addressed by the big budget network programs, you know, now had, there were black-owned radio stations playing this new kind of disturbing music, this kind of music that parents found unsettling that pretty soon became rock and roll music. So really a complete rebirth of the medium as kind of a localized, personalized medium of music and news.
It still had some advantages over even the networks, I would think, in terms of the immediacy of the programming it could provide, though. I mean, TV, you had to get a camera crew over there, and maybe you'd have to do some quick editing, and it was much more cumbersome then than it is now. Did radio have any kind of a news edge there over television?
Well, that's for certain, yes. Television news was actually one of the slower things to take off because the equipment was so bulky and a lot of it was still being shot on film into the 1960s. So, yes, radio could be there. It could be instant. It could record, you know, things as they happen that could be played back. And I think that's why news began to dominate. If you weren't thinking about radio for music, you were thinking about radio for news. And it's still that way. Radio is a very flexible medium. It's less expensive. The voice can convey a lot, as can sound. And sometimes, let's face it, pictures just get in the way, as I think we might have heard with the Freeberg had we gone on. And that's just, you know, one example of how radio reinvented itself. It's, you know, gone on to do that several times. I'm not sure how many lives it's used up yet, but I don't know if it's up to 9.
What about the relationship between radio and politics as you go from no longer having to rely on fireside chats or radio as the main medium to reach people if you were an elected official? What difference do you start seeing?
Well, it certainly is interesting that, you know, radio, as it became localized, actually sort of became revitalized as a political medium. And for a while there, now some would say that we've reached sort of the end of that over broadcast radio, although we're skipping ahead a bit to the 1990s and the concentration of ownership. And skipping ahead again, I do want to talk about podcasting. And I tell you, if you look at the number of politicians who are using radio podcasts now to get out to their constituency, it is amazing.
What would you call the sort of the worst year of radio history? In other words, was there a time when it really seemed as if the predictions of its demise might come true?
Well, they say, and I've looked at varying statistics, but by the early 1960s, radio listening in terms of time spent with the radio had plummeted. A lot of that had gone to TV. You know, people used to, they were up to 7 or 8 hours a day listening to radio. Now it dropped down to around 2 or 3. So in many ways, that was the nadir of radio listening. What happened to bring that back was the rise of FM. And now we tend to think, of course, when we turn on a radio, we automatically almost turn to FM radio. It's the place where all of the good stations are. But in the 1960s, at the beginning of FM, it was really not so certain that it was going to survive. The band was mostly just rebroadcasting AM radio, music not of the terrifically high quality and voice, but it was, you know, dual casting. And if you owned an AM station, you might own the FM, and you just put the signal out over both of them. However, it was during the 1960s, the mid-1960s to the early 1970s, when one thing that happened is that radio started to become, because it was deserted, FM became the place where, as one historian, Michael Keith, has said, all the weird hippies went.
Fire Sign Theater,
yes.
That was their heyday, FM radio.
You could pay them nothing. They were happy just to go into the studio and play their records and waffle on and, you know, make strange political pronouncements. And that kind of use of FM in the 60s helped to revitalize that part of the band.
I'm reminded of what the film industry did at the same time in response to this threat from television. That is, suddenly you get Panavision. You know, you work with what you have. So
Smell-o-vision.
Well, 3D,
that never took off.
Which had been off and on over the years, but 3D became a rage for a while in the early 50s. And radio was doing the same thing. I guess they had audio, that's what they had to offer. And so what can you do but make it more exciting somehow?
Music and voice. And so, you know, with people that you can reach through music, a certain kind of music that they can't get elsewhere, and then also weird voices saying sometimes strange things. I think there's always been part of that on radio, and certainly in the 60s, that's how FM came back.
To what extent was radio then dependent on cars? You know, because you can't watch television while driving, but you can listen to the radio. And I mean, if you look at the who was listening and where, did it become more and more a thing that was for people who were commuting or driving?
Well, certainly, you know, those concepts of radio drive time, which we still, now that's prime time. I mean, it's hard for us to remember that, you know, prime time radio used to be like prime time TV. It was in the evenings when people would sit down and listen. Then it became sort of dispersed. Nobody knew what to do, what was a prime time. And then slowly drive time emerged, the morning and the evening, when more and more cars, starting in the 1960s, had car radios built in. And then FM car radios, I don't know if you can remember, but on my first car did not have FM radio,
yes.
But by the 1970s, most did, and that became one of the biggest audiences.
And you can easily track what drive time was by the ad rates.
Which are much higher during that time, that's right. Really, I think there's three things. There's morning drive time, which depends on the city. I think Madison's must start at 4 a.m. as far as I can tell. I should check
that. It's hard to find the beginning of it.
Yes, and goes until, you know, 9 or 10 o'clock, whereas in New York, I think they consider drive, well, I shouldn't say that. It used to be 7, but I think it's earlier now with the commuting. And then the daytime is actually, you know, radio in the workplace is a rising phenomenon, especially nowadays with the sort of smooth, syndicated music formats. Apparently, a lot of listening goes on in the workplace, and then you're evening drive time.
I wonder if the retreat of radio to format and AM radio in particular at the beginning didn't have a lot to do with the rise of rock and roll, because wasn't rock and roll a format that really didn't require very high fidelity of sound? In other words, it was loud for most of the 2.5, 3.5 minutes, and you didn't have to worry about the nuances that you would need an FM radio for.
Certainly, yes, not like classical music. And a lot of things. It wasn't, I think rock and roll certainly was a byproduct of the sort of confluence of radio being a medium that was looking for a new purpose, the new youth culture, you know, the rise of teen culture, and then also the new demographic patterns of black and white populations now living together in the big cities of the North and Midwest where they'd migrated during World War II. So you had all that kind of come together and create this form of music. But we shouldn't forget that there was a lot of other music on radio at that time as well, pop, what they used to call middle of the road.
And were there some programs that jumped from radio to TV only to find out that they didn't adapt well?
There were some formats that were tried out on television that seemed to work better on radio, at least for a while. And these were a lot of the talk show formats. Of course, talk shows would become very important on TV, but during the 50s and 60s, that was regarded as a less successful phenomenon, and you found most of your talk shows on the radio. And I often think of the career of Mary Margaret McBride, who was one of the original talk show hosts. I mean, she more or less invented the unscripted radio talk about everyday events and then interviewing celebrities in the 1930s in her own syndicated shows. She was a middle-aged woman of, shall we say, comfortable proportions and a face that no one would stop and look at twice, and she had a propensity towards wearing big hats. And when she went on television, it was not a good combination, and unfortunately her career sort of declined. She did have her own primetime television show in the early 1950s, but it was when, as they say, she had a radio face.
It was interesting how many radio entertainment shows went straight to television. I'm not sure how many of them actually pulled it off. I mean, some people were just more interesting to look at than others. I was surprised to find, you know, for example, that Fibber McGee and Molly were on TV, whereas I think that must have just, you know, gone down the tubes pretty quickly, whereas somebody like Jack Benny pulled it off for years.
Could have a long career.
Burns and Gracie Allen.
I've always been rather glad. Oh, I shouldn't say this. I'm actually devastated that Fanny Brice died at an early age. But had she tried to take the baby Snooks to television at the age of 48, I'm not sure how that would have worked.
What about the relationship between American radio TV intersection and British? We talked about that last time and that there's a parallel going on, but is what's happening with radio history here dependent on what's happening abroad?
Well, I think one really interesting example of how radio in its flexible and infinitely variable form can make itself fit into different situations is the fact that in England, where the BBC controlled radio, yes, there was a lot more continuity of radio drama, radio comedy, radio serious radio programs still on the air. But what didn't get on the air was pop music. The Beatles, in fact, in order to hear the songs that they would begin to do covers for and then eventually evolve their own style out of, they had to get discs, you know, smuggled over from the U.S., well, shipped over. And it was, they couldn't hear it on the air until, in the late 1950s, the pirate ships, the famous rock and roll pirate ships, literally ships anchored off the coast of England, of the Netherlands, of France, began to broadcast pop music, rock and roll music, into Britain and other European countries from offshore. Some of these became really famous and had really ardent fan bases. A lot of them, too, were done by Americans. It was, you know, American radio operators or entrepreneurs who would go over and start up these ships. But not all of them. Some of them were, you know, started by Europeans. And this was hugely influential on the rock and roll scene in Europe.
What about educational uses of radio? I mean, we know here at Wisconsin Public Radio, where there's a university there going way back with the idea of school of the year. What about nationwide in terms of radio as seen as something where you could get an education through it?
Well, that's a very interesting thread of history that I think is so often forgotten about, the history of educational radio in the United States that carries right over into public radio today. And I want to give a shout out here to one of my favorite neglected figures in broadcasting history. Her name is Frieda Hennock, and she was the first female FCC commissioner, took office in the late 1940s through the early 1950s. And I have to say that more than any one person, she was the one who single-handedly, she just fixated on the idea of getting those lower frequencies in the FM band set aside for nonprofit and educational broadcasting. That idea had come up before. It had been defeated, but she was able to get it through. And it's really through her efforts more than anyone else that we have public radio today.
88 through 92 FM,
88 through 92. And, you know, it's really great. You can go to any city in the United States and fumble around in that band, and you know you're going to come across a public radio station, at least one, also community community radio, also religious broadcasters and sort of, you know, marginal nonprofit groups, low power to a certain extent, although that can be all over. But I think that that thread of broadcasting that brought us then public radio finally in 1970 and on today is really kind of an unsung story. I know we were making jokes about pledge drives and how public radio might talk about itself then, but I think public radio has really innovated a lot in the art of sound over the last 20 years in particular. It's just remarkable what's going on in public radio today.
It's interesting how far back that idea goes. I was reading a Florida newspaper from December 31st, 1929, the other day, that had an article in it about a proposal for an educational radio network. And the headline was, "Idea Considered Premature." But there were actually some early attempts to have these little configurations conveying the signal via shortwave, and I guess they didn't quite come to anything for a while in terms of a network.
And actually, there had been proposals around the Communications Act of 1934 to set aside bands of the radio spectrum for nonprofit broadcasting. But you may have heard about the interesting definitions of stations. The FCC, in its wisdom, decided that really commercial stations could best serve the public interest because they would let anyone on the air who would pay for their time. Therefore, they were general public interest stations, whereas stations who wanted to educate about a particular topic or had a point of view, like a labor union, or they were propaganda stations.
Well, that's interesting take on it. So they're really saying that if you have the money, then you are in the public interest.
Something like that, yes. And it's the money that makes the gate open if you're the gatekeeper for radio. And if you just want to tell somebody about something, that's not as good an idea, at least not as far as the early broadcast regulators were concerned.
Are there legal battles in the 1950s over what can and cannot happen on radio and who's in charge?
Well, there was certainly a major scandal, and most people know a little bit about the quiz show scandal that happened around that time because we've seen the movie about that. But there was also the payola scandal, which really came first and helped to kind of set the stage for the quiz show scandal. And that's when people discovered, shock, that DJs, in some cases, were taking payments to promote music on the air. Now, that sounds bad. On the other hand, a lot of the DJs were investors in recording companies themselves. They tended to be promoters of the career. They did. They were very intimately concerned with the promotion of certain artists. So there was this system where they had a lot of influence.
Conflict of interest?
Conflict of interest, perhaps. And in fact, I believe it's still the case that if you look at the credits for Chuck Berry's classic hit Maybelline, you will find that Alan Freed is actually listed as a co-writer.
He didn't have anything
to do with it.
The DJ best known as sort of the father of rock and roll.
He helped to promote Chuck Berry's career, and that's how he got on there. The interesting reasoning behind it, I think, was stated the best in some of the hearings. People said, "Everyone knows that music is trash. How are they cramming it down the throats of our youth?"
That was the tip-off,
It must be corruption. I think everyone was a little shocked when they cracked down on the DJs, took away a lot of the payola that had been going on, and rock and roll still persisted as a medium. You just couldn't stop the kids from listening
to it. There still has to be, well, money notwithstanding, this big gray area between what is not to be on the radio and what is to be on the radio, even in any given format. And it's so crucial to an artist to get that airplay.
And we've certainly had the resurgence of those fears, what with the radio concentration, the concentration of ownership of radio stations after the Telecommunications Act of 96, where you have, you know, the famous Dixie Chicks incident. I think most people have probably heard of where the Dixie Chicks made an anti-war statement at a concert, and some Clear Channel stations banned playing their recordings, although I think it was probably blown up to be a bit more than it was. You get that resurgence of concern. You know, who's making the decisions? Of course, that's only one way that we get music these days, so it's a little bit different from back in the 1940s.
More on the history of radio when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guest again this week is Michelle Hilmes, and this time out, we're talking about radio, and particularly how viable is radio when we have all these new media emerging. How far back does talk radio go?
Well, of course, talk is one of the first things that was ever put out on a radio wave besides the Morse code that the amateurs used to use back in the teens. And there was a lot of talk on radio's prime time, especially during the day and even in the late evening hours. But I think we associate talk radio as we experience it today, starting from the mid to late 1980s. And what with the FM becoming the really mainstream part of the radio band and being mostly taken up with music, because, of course, FM was better for broadcasting music, especially stereo and more sophisticated forms of recording as you get into the 80s, talk was really left to the AM band. And there was a while there in the 1980s when it looked like the AM band might be dying out. There were far fewer stations on the air. And, of course, those used to be the valuable bands. And now,
especially the big clear channel stations.
And they, you know, were losing audiences. People were selling off the stations. It really was beginning to look like kind of a radio wasteland. And then in the mid to late 80s, suddenly there's a revival that's predicated around talk radio. And a few things had happened. For one thing, 800 numbers had been introduced around then so that you could call in from a long distance.
Talk program.
Yes, and bring in callers from all over and not just from your local area. Satellite broadcasting started making stations able to transmit all over so that shows could be syndicated and picked up all around the country rather than just in their locality. So radio really transforms itself. And, of course, this is true of FM and AM, but it transforms itself again from a local medium to a national medium. And talk radio really benefited from that. You also, of course, have the kind of colorful political things that were going on in the 80s and early 90s.
Always plenty to talk about.
Particularly with the Republican Revolution in the early 1990s. And suddenly we see the rise of political talk show hosts like Rush Limbaugh and many others who revitalized first the AM, and then, of course, they begin to be carried all over.
In the recent movie Talk to Me, they portray the radio station in Washington, D.C., and the way that after the King assassination, for people to call in and share their grief or their anger or whatever became sort of almost like therapy. If you could call in anonymously in a way that you couldn't to television, it seemed to play that role. Would you say, if you're looking at the history of talk radio, that's one of the things radio can do, is give people a place to sound off and not be seen?
Well, I think that's true in that it's less intimidating to be calling in with, the anonymity that your voice might afford rather than, you know, being on television. It's also easier to do. You can pick up a cell phone as we get into the 90s, you know, from your car and call in. You can be at home. You're really still a private citizen, but you're venturing out there onto the public airwaves and engaging in this national public conversation. And I think that is very therapeutic. And also, of course, you know, we see the rise of shows like Dr. Ruth Vestheimer,
these, yes.
Dr. Ruth, and Dr. Laura.
Advice and help shows.
Advice and help, with people calling in with the most intimate questions and problems, but doing it under the anonymity of radio.
With the rest of us sort of eavesdropping on all these private lives.
One difference now, maybe. I don't know how much difference it's made, though, but they may be anonymous to the listener, but they no longer are anonymous to the radio station, because you can track any number from anywhere now, it seems.
And find out who made that call in. And yes, with internet radio, the possibilities are even more extreme, perhaps. But I think, yes, we worry about the eavesdropping, especially under today's relaxation of some of the laws protecting it. But I do think that in the beginning of talk radio, this was not, you know, something that was a concern.
Right.
And it certainly did provide, you know, a new way to have a public discussion. So I think that the rise of talk radio, you know, really added to the public sphere here and in countries all over the world. And then the other thing I guess I should mention on the AM band that helped to repopulate it, so that now, I don't know if you've noticed, but AM is just about as full again of stations as it ever was, is the rise of foreign language broadcasting.
Yes,
Spanish
indeed.
Language in
yes.
particular, but also Chinese and Korean and Arabic and all kinds of broadcasting in different languages, which we'd had a lot of actually back in the 1920s and 30s. But slowly, as the rules tightened up during wartime and also as immigration was really sort of cut off, we lost most of our foreign language stations, and they've really just come back in the last 20 years.
I don't think this is more than a fringe effect either, and yet it's a colorful one. And that is another effect that you get with AM radio, is that skywave effect, where if you're listening to your car radio at night, you can listen to St. Louis and listen to their talk show from Madison, Wisconsin, or you can listen to WABC in New York.
just over the airwaves.
Yes, yeah,
that's
just over your
remarkable.
Car radio.
Mm-hmm. Yes, a radio, shortwave radio, too. Now, there is an area that has almost died out. There's much less shortwave broadcasting going on now than there used to be. And I suppose this would be like a hidden side of radio that most of us don't even know about because most of us don't have shortwave receivers. But during World War II, that's when shortwave broadcasting really reached a peak, and the various powers involved in the war were, you know, broadcasting propaganda all over the shortwave bands, which, you know, you could have a station in Berlin that could reach Argentina. It was remarkable.
And still goes on mm-hmm. quite a bit, although the content seems to have shifted toward evangelicals even more than it was 40 or 50 years ago.
Religious broadcasting truly is a huge field now, and I think it's been very little studied, but yes, enormously influential all around the world. And I forget exactly what proportion of the stations on the air are religious broadcasters, but it is a growing proportion, and it's quite substantial.
HCJB out of Quito for years, I guess, and still is a big power because they have the money to provide the power mm-hmm. to get it out.
Well, speaking of money, is some of it economic in the sense that it's extremely cheap to have a talk show? If your entire program is a host and then you have an open line and people call in and share whatever's on their mind, you haven't had to produce anything the way you would with a radio drama, and it certainly isn't the big bucks of a television show or a film. How much of it is radio struggling to stay alive on a low budget?
Well, it's absolutely true that, you know, there's nothing less expensive to produce than a talk show. Simply sitting some people around some microphones and having them talk and, you know, ask questions, take calls. It can be done, you know, on a really minimal budget. That's why, to talk for a moment about another kind of pirate radio, that's another kind of invisible area that we don't see. At various times in this country, and today still in Europe a lot, there are people on the air who simply got a little transmitter, maybe at their equivalent of Radio Shack, got a couple microphones and went on the air, played some records, had some talks. And pirate radio is very much out there, despite all the rules against it, and I think probably always will be.
What's the difference between that kind of pirate radio and ham radio?
Well, ham radio operators are on another part of the band.
They are. Yeah.
And it's easy for them to get a license. And most of them do get a license of some kind. You just basically have to fill out a form and send it in. So they communicate on a completely with specialized radios on a different part of the radio spectrum. It's almost like a club. I mean, it had its own clubhouse up there on these higher radio waves.
But they don't cross the line between just having a chat with another ham operator and playing music or making political commentary or having their own call-in show.
Well, I'm sure some of that must go on. But in many ways, I think our ham community, they've tended over the years to be a pretty disciplined bunch of people who really pride themselves on taking their role seriously and not actually. I believe the rules are still in place that forbid some of those activities by ham operators, like the provision of news and the playing of music. I mean, there actually were rules put in place back in the 1920s.
And I suppose they can't sell things either.
You know, I'm not sure.
I was in the Bahamas a few years ago and listening to ship-to-ship communications, and there's actually a regularly scheduled show in which the ships would talk to each other, and they would say something effective, well, I have this refrigerator that I don't need anymore, and I'll be glad to talk about it. They can say that they're selling it. They can't mention the prices. They always talk around that. In fact, if somebody slips, then the moderator will come on and correct them.
I'm not surprised by that because, yes, there were pretty stringent rules put on the hams back in the 20s.
Well, shifting over to the pirate radio, to be a pirate radio station, what is it you're doing other than to sort of be on the airwaves without a license?
Well, that's primarily it. I mean, you do still in this day and age, if you're going to use the airwaves, you got to have a license. That's spectrum. It's regulated by the federal government. You need a license to be on there. Often you won't get caught unless you're doing something that the license is supposed to prevent. That is trampling over somebody else's frequency so that you're interrupting their signal. And that's often how pirate operators get caught. We had quite a lot of pirates on the air in the early 1990s in this country. And then finally, and that increased actually through the mid-90s until the Low Power FM Act came in. And now the FCC has created a lot of very low power stations that can kind of be slotted in between the frequencies that are out there on the FM band. And those licenses have begun to be taken up. And I think it's cut down, apparently, on the number of pirates that we have on the air today, although I'm not sure anyone's really sure.
Now, what about all those student radio stations?
Well, now, they are perfectly legal.
Well, apart from that, I mean, where do they slide those into the spectrum?
You know, it's interesting. Student radio, certainly university radio, has been around as long as radio itself, as we could point to our very own WHA here at the University of Wisconsin. But a lot of student radio stations actually got transformed into public radio stations when public radio came in. And then you have your community radio stations. We have a very good one here in Madison called WORT, which is owned by the community. It's run by a nonprofit board. Student radio, I think, has occupied yet another slot because most universities and colleges do have student radio stations, and they've been really important places where people are trained in radio, where new music gets debuted, and there's a whole system of conferences and publications and various things that get new music out to student radio. So that's another thing usually found in that band between 88 and 92, but not always, that's really contributed a lot to sound culture, I think.
You mentioned public radio coming along in 1970. What difference did that make in terms of how other stations sell themselves?
Well, I certainly think – I think public radio has been at the forefront of a lot of the innovations in terms of satellite-delivered shows because it was, you know, being a loosely connected network of local public stations that had to put their funds together to create programs that then could be shared. A lot of the early syndicating was done in public radio. A lot of innovative talk programs have gone on public radio. And now it's very interesting to see public radio getting back into comedy and drama, you know, and original sound production in a way that I don't think we've seen in this country for a long time. It's very encouraging.
To the extent that budgets allow.
That budgets allow.
What's the status of network radio then? These days, you know, CBS, for example, in particular, seemed to be the one that was around or prominent longest.
Well, you know, basically by the 1960s, certainly by the late 1960s, most of the networks had either gotten out of radio networking completely or all that it amounted to was a news network. So you would have, you know, news feeds on the half hour or the hour or whatever, but that really was the network. I think the very last dramatic show to go off the air, this is what I like to say anyway, it's a nice story, was Ma Perkins. Some may remember the soap opera Ma Perkins that had been on since the early days, and Ma bid her audience a tearful farewell in 1960, and I believe that was the last radio drama show to go off, and that was the end of the non-news era.
One thing that seemed ironic to me was the film A Prairie Home Companion. In other words, if you have a movie about a radio show and about it going off the air and so on.
I probably should have mentioned Garrison Keillor specifically because I think, you know, more than anybody, any other program, that certainly made an impact on American consciousness about radio as still a viable art form and the kinds of things that one can do on the air that it's much harder to do on TV. It's interesting, too, you may note that, you know, variety shows used to be all over television. They'd come from radio. Then they'd vanish. They disappeared. Now, there's not many, but there are a few back on radio again, and Garrison Keillor's is a good example of that, with really interesting playing around with the medium, with sound effects, you know, just the art that sound can do uniquely, I think. And certainly he revitalized, I think his show helped to revitalize the whole era of syndicated public radio programs.
Is there a fundamental difference, though, in the amount of attention you have to pay to radio versus television?
Well, you know, that's a debatable point. A lot of people worried when television came in it was going to be terrible for the American family because women wouldn't be able to do the housework while watching television the way they could while listening to radio. You know, so maybe you didn't want that TV if you didn't want to have, you know, a terribly filthy house. Well, it turns out that, you know, it's just amazing what you can do while watching TV. The television somehow is a lot of it is built to really not demand your constant attention. And I should point out that the sound element of TV is very important there. The television may be a visual medium, but it's also a sound medium, and it holds our attention with the sound and calls us back to the set when we need to get back for something.
It is an interesting exercise to listen to television, just to listen to it.
Which one can do if you have a TV band radio, too.
Well, there's that or even just being in the room with it but not actually facing TV and seeing how often it is or is not dependent upon the audio. Mm-hmm.
So much is, and yet, of course, we all know that there are programs where a lot is being conveyed visually, and maybe that's, you know, a mark of a really good television program as opposed to one that is, you know, primarily sound-oriented. But certainly still, the amount of time that people spend with the television on. Now, who knows if they're actually actively watching it all that time. But it's still greater than the time that they spend with the radio on, or so they report. But radio listening has actually been going up. I mean, you'd think it would be going down, but it's actually been increasing.
Literally radio, not just the various other audio sources, but radio.
Well, now
broadcast.
We get into some important distinctions, right? You know, what is radio? And so not necessarily all radio listening, I think, is done over the air these days. But counting in the kind of radio that people pick up over the internet via satellite and things, yes, the
hours are going
up. But still coming
from a broadcasting entity of some kind.
Yes.
It's going up.
We're going to talk about some of those new ways to listen to the so-called radio in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Michelle Hilmes, and we're talking about how viable is radio. Michelle Hilmes is the author of Radio Voices, A Cultural History of American Broadcasting, and also, more recently, A History of NBC. If you look at radio today, how different is it because you can also tune into the radio on the internet?
Well, I think that we're on the brink of, you know, a real change. And this is as big as the change that occurred when television came in the 1940s and early 50s. And I think it crept up on us. Certainly the music industry has been feeling the heat for a little while, but most of us are still, we turn on the radio, we listen to our radio programs. Some of us have made the switch, and I know I'm one of those. When I get the chance, I love to listen to podcasts that I can download. And I find what's nice about that is there's these wonderful programs on the BBC, on radio stations in Canada and in other parts of the world that I can now get access to that I couldn't before. But I think what has happened, and this is, I'm sure, obvious to many people, is that the era of the internet, the digital age of media, that debuted, I suppose, right around 1994 when some of the first internet radio stations, if you want to call them that, went not on the air but on the wire, so to speak. But I think it's only in the last 4 or 5 years with the prevalence of high-speed connections, of Wi-Fi, of things like iPods, that most of us have become aware of this this world of digital media. And the question is, you know, where does radio fit in? Now, meantime, in the radio world, as we've been saying, radio went through a period of concentration of ownership, of a lot of kind of consolidation of formats, where commercial radio has tended to sound more and more like wherever you go, it's the same syndicated formats playing. Seems like you're getting calls in from that area, but in fact, they could be coming in from anywhere. It's all, you know, national or even globally syndicated. Decline of local ownership and local programming in stations, although I would say that's offset somewhat with the rise of community and public radio. But so over the air, traditional radio is kind of in a rut. And in fact, listener hours and ratings have been declining over the last few years in many cities. And in fact, I think even Clear Channel at this point is selling off some of its radio stations. Meantime, as the recording industry was the first to note, people were starting to download music. And in fact, in my classes now, when I ask my students, how many hours a day do you spend listening to radio? Some of them never listen to radio, but they say, oh, do you mean listening to music that I download onto my computer? Okay. Now, if we include that, hours and hours. So digital music downloads started to get the recording industry upset. And then internet radio, which can be of two kinds. It can be the kind where you have a radio station that's actually on the air and they simply have a digital equivalent so that you could also listen to them online if you wanted to. Or they might be a station, so to speak, that just exists on the internet. You know, simply somebody that has the kind of equipment that you need to send out a stream of audio online. Those have proliferated and there's just hundreds, if not thousands of them out there now offering all different kinds of radio fare.
And are they required to get a license?
Absolutely not. And do they need to abide by the obscenity or indecency rules that some people like Howard Stern have gotten slapped with lately? No, they are not. And of course, either is where Howard Stern landed, which is satellite radio, another part of the spectrum which is not regulated by the FCC. So now we have, you know, what used to be radio, which is music, talk, in some kind of a streaming format, perhaps, by satellite. Over our cable, some of us, if we have cable, we have those music channels that just play nothing but music. Over our internet, onto our computers. And now that we can download as discrete programs onto our iPods and take with us wherever we want to go. Also in our cars, and same for satellite. And now, apparently, the next wave, of course, is over our cell phones, will be able to listen to, you know, any number of these things. The question is, you know, is this radio? And what is it doing? I think the more interesting question is, what can we do now that we couldn't before, or vice versa?
And what are we losing in the process of all that?
And what might we lose?
Because sometimes, you know, you have a sense that there may be hundreds of options, but it's so overwhelming that you can get lost in it.
And not only get lost, but also maybe get stuck into little narrow pathways that, you know, you wouldn't even know that the rest of it is out there. I was recently getting ready to – I'm teaching a history of broadcasting class, and I'm, you know, trying to get myself to review some of the more recent developments. And I was scanning through on iTunes some of the podcasts that are out there. I knew I listen regularly to some, but I was just amazed to find a whole new genre that I hadn't even known was there before, the travel podcast, where you can go to a city and take tours of that city listening to programs that you've downloaded onto your iPod.
This is Robert Wright. And our London walk today is going to take us around Bloomsbury. And we're going to particularly link the walk today with the work of Charles Dickens. That's the most famous of English Victorian authors. And I'm starting.
No more fumbling with guidebooks, you know. No more asking directions from surly foreigners.
And what's in it for the podcaster, though?
Well, and that's a question, because I think most of these that I've downloaded are free. And I believe that if you go to their website, you'll see some pop-up ads. Some of them market ancillary products like, oh, buy our tapes or buy our books or, you know, some kind of, you know, buy our T-shirts.
Get right? You like halfway through the tour, as it turns out. Like, for more,
yes,
buy this
right.
book.
And
now that you're stranded in the city.
And now turn into this dark alley and pay that person $20 before you can go forward. But there's just anything you could want out there. And I brought along a few titles I thought people might find interesting. I'm not endorsing any of these, but there's an incredible amount of political podcasts, as we talked about, including podcasts being put out by our government and especially the military branches for families in the military, soldiers that are stationed here and there. And the one that caught my eye was one called Rucksacks and Rations, the Pentagon Channel. So for free, tune in if you like. Another one that I thought was very interesting was the Southeastern Paranormal Society, which is for ghost hunters in the Southeast. Everything you wanted to know. Two very local and I think interesting uses, like the Missouri Botanical Gardens has a podcast on plants in bloom. Find out what's in bloom now. Listen to the podcast. There's also a lot of religious podcasts, as you can imagine, just like there are broadcasting stations. One that I ran across was called Pray As You Go, obviously for iPod owners, put out by the Jesuit Media Institute. And the other one that I have to say I did find listed on the religious site was called Oh God, I'm Gay. So,
well, explain to us how the podcast works.
Okay. A podcast, essentially, there's a type of a syndication software that was invented, I guess, about 4 or 5 years ago. And essentially, a podcast is an audio program that is recorded and then sent out to a central site where, from which it can be downloaded onto people's individual computers or iPods.
This is a download from the BBC. To find out more, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.
Now, from our own correspondent, introduced by Kate Hady.
Good morning. Today, there's a picnic in the bush for old enemies in Uganda. Alarm bells ring in Washington at the prospect of the return of the man who led the Nicaraguan Revolution nearly 30 years ago. We find a tiny corner of the Soviet Union preserved amid the ice north of the Arctic Circle, and discover how history's left its mark on the Black Sea coastline, where Churchill, Roosevelt and Stalin met to carve up post-war Europe.
And it has a feature that I think is really crucial to the idea of what we call radio, which is it's not streaming all the time. It's not like radio where you turn it on and you're always going to hear something that's being sent out at that moment. But it does recur. You know, it recurs weekly or daily. There's a new show. It's something that is streaming over time in the sense that it's not just an individual performance, but something that you can subscribe to.
It's a program in the sense that radio used to have programs.
Exactly.
But archived, unlike radio used to be?
Yes, available anytime you want to listen to it or download it, not tied to a schedule, and also portable. Of course, radio has become certainly very portable in these last 20, 30 years, but, you know, portable through time as well as space now.
So the iPod is specifically linked to this satellite source, download?
It's really an internet source. I mean, it comes over the internet. And so, you know, it's and the iPod, you don't have to have a I'm using iPod in sort of the generic sense and not – I'm not getting – credit from Apple Corporation for saying that over and over again. But any kind of portable recorder or computer can play these podcasts.
So if somebody tells me, oh, yes, I listen to University of the Air, you know, I podcast it, what's really the difference then between that and someone who simply goes to our public radio website, finds the audio archives, and listens to last week's program? Because you can find any of our titles for the last year and hit listen, and you'll hear it at your own time on a computer. So what's the point then of the podcast? Just that you've signed up for it to be there without you doing anything?
I guess the difference would be between subscribing to a magazine and going out to the newsstand and buying it every day, or to a newspaper. If you subscribe, it comes to you. And in fact, when you plug in your listening device to your computer, it will automatically download. You'll get it. Whereas, you know, if you go out to the newsstand, you pick it up, you might miss a day or two. So it's really just a difference in convenience. I think the form stays the same, but the listening experience is more like what we associate with radio.
Now, are there such things as what might be called sort of bulletin iPod casts, in the sense that somebody's in Tiananmen Square and something's happening there and it's all very spontaneous? Can they put up a spontaneous podcast that will be heard around the world?
There are certainly sites now that are especially associated with people's blogs, where you have people that are going online and posting news and that sort of thing on a daily or even hourly basis. And audio and video now, too, I should point out. You can also do a video podcast these days, but they can be posted at the same time. So that if now how do you know where to tune? I mean, I think that's the kind of question that probably pops into most of our minds. And I think that's that idea that how you can get into a narrow rut, because you go to certain sites all the time and you're getting even this very contemporaneous news that's coming down, whereas you may never go to another site. On the other hand, it's very interesting what's out there that we never really had access to before when, you know, in this country we are used to being able to get, but in any individual location, probably 15 broadcasting stations, you know, maybe 20 or 25 if you're living in a big city. Well, you know, now we all have access to thousands, literally.
But credibility?
Very good question. And, you know, I think the only thing that's going to determine that is just research and exposure over time. But certainly no licenses are involved.
And when you were gathering those titles you shared with us, like about the Missouri Botanical Gardens or the Oh God, I'm Gay site or whatever, were you simply, in order to get a listing, in order to see what you might use, how are you doing that? Just through some regular search engine? Or?
Well, I was going through iTunes. Again, a little plug for Apple, I guess it ends up being. But through iTunes, which is one of the better developed sites on the web. And there, you know, you go to the podcast section and they've actually categorized podcasts into various things, like public radio is one, and there are a lot of public radio podcasts on there. The BBC programs are there. But, you know, art, culture, sports, games. Now, you know, you don't have to just go home and play the World of Warcraft. You can actually listen to podcasts about it, too. Hobbies, all kinds of, you know, different categories. And then there are usually, you know, 50 to 100 podcasts in each one of those.
All right. What about, though, it seems inevitable, video components? We know that you can already shoot short videos with a cell phone and send those around. So is TV going to win out again?
Well, I tell you, it's starting to predominate. You can go to the podcast site, and it's no longer all audio podcasts. There are video podcasts, too, more and more of them. And, you know, of course, the kind of emblematic video on the web is the YouTube phenomenon, where I think you were named Man of the Year, Person of the Year last year by Time, part of the YouTube thing?
Yes, that's right. Yes. You see a mirror on the cover of Time magazine.
But now, if you are just it's too overwhelming to go to the YouTube site and keep up on the little videos that everyone is posting, you can get the YouTube podcast and simply subscribe to, you know, the daily best of YouTube.
Selected by...
Someone will select it. Well, again, you ask the hard question. And I think actually this will become kind of the interesting thing in the next 5 years, which is who are the gatekeepers? Who will be making these selections? And how will people know about them? And actually, that's where I think that the existing media will enter in through the back door if they're not already there. I can go to the NPR sites, the podcasts, because I already know NPR. I know it's a good source. And therefore, I'll pick those sites. And that's what I think is going to be the main presence of many broadcasters today is the brand, if you will, the name, the reputation.
And then let's see. And then that selecting person will, for your convenience, start sequencing them, and you'll be right back to where you were in 1949.
And I wouldn't doubt it. I think that streaming, we're at the point now where everybody thinks, oh, it's great to be able to download the songs that I individually want and just listen to them when I want. But actually, I think there's a great value in being able to turn something on that has selected something for you that flows out what we call streaming in the sense of
and the surprise. Surprise of not knowing what you're getting.
Exactly.
Let me ask you this, too, as we gear up where it's just going to be a little over a year now until the presidential election, how do you see all these different kinds of radio methods kicking in?
Well, already all the major candidates have their audio and video podcasts there. I just happened to see Hillary Clinton's. I saw a lot for the Bush administration. I wasn't looking specifically. But I think that, you know, more and more, instead of advertising and appearing on mainstream media, people are selecting and, you know, listening on their own, which I regard as a benefit. Actually, I think you can get more in-depth material through these methods than you can just on those campaign ads, certainly, or those highly staged debates that we've become used to. Now, again, where's the fact-checking? Well, it's interesting because what has sprung up, as you probably know, on the Internet lately are those sites that check the facts in each of the presidential State of the Union address, and I think we'll see more of that. But I see this as an extremely important site for political information. And in fact, going along with what you were just saying, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a Hillary channel and a Giuliani channel and an Obama channel, just streaming information. And that will become the norm, I would imagine. I'd be willing to bet in politics over the next couple of years.
Well, it sounds like it could be, yes, a new forum for politics that wouldn't necessarily be keyed to the routinized steps of the campaigns that we've become used to, where everything is so totally laid out and formulaic now.
But of course, you know, podcasts are recorded, and that is one difference. People sometimes say, well, you know, what was so great about radio is it's live.
The immediacy. Mm-hmm.
And even where a show is recorded, it's usually done live. That is to say, at one point you have people in a studio talking or, you know, actually doing something that involves selection and sequencing in some kind of a live order. And when it's streaming, it feels live. There's a liveness there in that quality. And I think it'll be interesting to see how that is managed, because it could be as staid and as recorded as an extended campaign ad unless the creators are careful to keep up that impression.
Well,
how would you answer the question that we use as the title of this hour, how viable is radio?
I think radio will always survive. I think there's something about the human voice and what it can convey that will always be a medium in its own right. But what is radio? I regard it as anything that is sound-oriented and in some kind of temporal sequencing. That's not a very sexy definition. But I do think that in that sense, that we will always have radio, whether it will be delivered over the air or not, I think is moot. Probably and. It will be over the air and via satellite and, you know, via other things. But I think radio has survived for, you know, more than 100 years. I don't see it dying out anytime too soon.
Michelle Hilmes, thanks for spreading the good word about radio with us for this hour. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll be able to listen to the next hour of University of the Air. Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, with Vladimir Putin stepping down and Russia awash in oil wealth, what will be the nature of the relationship between the United States and Russia in the years to come? For some ideas, join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.